Hello and welcome to Kicking It Off, the podcast for those interested in sports, football and the coaching of young children. Today, we're delighted to bring you part two of the Michici Files. Now, for those of our listeners who caught Dan's previous episode with us in series one, you'll know that there was a lot of ground to cover. So please feel free to re-listen to our first chat with Dan back in series one, episode four, so that you're up to speed. Dan's influence on youth development is widely respected, and his journey includes leading England's under-16s to a tournament cup win, serving as head coach at Arsenal's under-15 and under-18 squads, shaping top talent, and at the time of recording, Dan's role at Everton was guiding player transitions in their academy. We really hope you enjoy part two of this conversation. Dan, it's so great to have you back with us. We had some really great comments after the first episode, so thank you for joining us again as we try and pick up where we left off.
And where we left off, we'd all predicted that England were going to win the Euros.
Oh.
So, yeah, we got that wrong. But yeah. One of the players that you mentioned in the England setup when you were telling us about how you were working with those was Mark Gaye. And I think he was one player who really came out of the Euros with a lot of credit and really enhanced his reputation. You know, so I think that was quite pleasing. But I want to start with your work at MK Dons Academy, because some of our previous episodes have been around creativity and about making the game fit the player rather than the other way around. And I know the way that you started thinking at MK Dons was really quite forward thinking, definitely, and really creative. Can you tell us a little bit more about your thoughts behind that?
Yeah, I think for a start, I mean, just to give the viewers and listeners some context, in terms of resources, we had absolutely nothing compared to most, even back then, never mind now. So we had five pitches that we could use. The groundsman wasn't allowed on them at all year round. So they weren't maintained. So what we decided to do was have different size pitches for the five. So we started at 50 by 30, 60 by 40, 70 by 50, etc. And the thinking behind that came in terms of working with what we had. And they weren't for specific ages. So any age group could go on any pitch depending on what their needs were. And up to 80 by 60, we had offside lines in the thirds as well, because we felt that if the offside line was on the halfway line, that the game would just become a long ball game, which is what wasn't in line with our philosophy. And then in terms of like training facilities, we had a 60 by 40 dome. That was it. So you're trying to build a program where you're trying to get various age groups in a 60 by 40. So we managed to get agreement with local schools to use their sports hall. So we had a futsal program as well as a indoor training program / games program. And so, for example, the under 15s, for example, on one Monday might be in the indoor dome and play a match against a team 2-3 years older. And we used those fixtures as well for recruitment, because we only had one scout and he was part-time. He actually worked for a local printers and he did an amazing job looking back. He's probably the best scout I've ever worked with in terms of he was part-time, and the players he got in and what they've got on to do, it was incredible. And then the under 16s might be in the sports hall. And then we just swapped them over. So we built the program around variety, and that was all based off all the literature and all the academic research that the FA were doing around how children learn. So we felt learning the game in various ways was very important. And then again, in terms of the youth module, so it all sort of tied in well. The timing was very good because the youth modules were just coming in and we were very receptive to learning about this. And with all the literature around different types of practice design and what your returns are, we just decided to go far more towards the random practice end of the spectrum, because we just felt we don't have much space, we don't have many players, we don't have much time, so we just need to maximize every second we get. It was I wouldn't say it was like a grassroots program, but it was very much a, you wouldn't say it was an elite environment on the eye, but in terms of the returns we were getting, it was quite rapid, if you like.
Well, I think the thing that I picked up on through that, Dan, is this notion of volume and variety, and really presenting the game to the players in lots of different ways, so yes. that just through the variety, you are asking them to solve different problems with different numbers in a different space with different constraints. And I think that's a rich environment for learning. Was there any resistance to this? And I think I know what the answer might be.
Oh, lots. Yeah, there was lots of resistance. Again, looking back as we're speaking, what I was doing at the same time was I was actually writing for a Dutch coaching magazine on a monthly basis. So I kind of used that as a vehicle to the parents and the players and some of the coaches in terms of, if they could see that the philosophy was getting published, particularly in Holland, then we must be doing something. Each month I would write about something different, but all related to our program. So it served as a dual purpose. So that was quite a, looking back, that was quite a healthy way of getting messages out to them. And then get guest speakers in from the FA and to sort of support our messages. And because a lot of it's just education, really. And then I think just sticking to your beliefs because and just not wavering at all, but listening to people and giving them a voice. So we used to ask the parents for feedback about our program, what's working well. And we'd make it very specific. So we'd say, ask them about our communication. Do you think our communication is good, bad, or indifferent? If so, why? And then from the feedback, then we'd get those group of parents in to explain to them or get any ideas from them.
Yeah.
And then even with the player reviews that we do with the players, it was a lot of player ownership. So, and it wasn't like we always listened to what they were saying in terms of actioning it, but it would help us to understand we need to explain certain things in more detail. Just so they understand why, because why would they know why we're doing certain things? So I remember we had one age group that they were quite early developers physically, and so whenever they played away from home, it didn't matter who it was. It could be West Ham, Arsenal, because it wasn't EPPP then. So we were in a games program with all the, you know, so-called big hitters, and they would go and just beat them all comfortably. But then when we play at home, we'd put them on a smaller pitch and they would really struggle.
Yeah.
And they weren't happy with me, parents, players, because in their mind, they're thinking, don't get this. We've gone and won at Tottenham and now we're losing at home to whatever, whoever it might be, and not playing well. The boys are struggling. And, you know, I would just reinforce them. What's your aspiration? And they would say, I want to play at the highest level. I said, well, you've got to be able to do both then.
Yeah.
And again, just meant continuing with the education process of what the returns were and saying to the, and remind them as well, look, we as coaches could have our ego could get damaged by this. We as a coach might be getting in the car thinking, gosh, we've just been beaten 5-0. But what it's telling us is there's lots of work to do here.
Yeah.
So You hit the nail on the head there that it was about variety. We probably got the program too much one way at the start. It was too much about small pitches. And then what we learned quite quickly was, no, what they need is variety. It's not about a small pitch and it's not about a big pitch. And you know, and it went again in terms of the program itself, and it all tied into like our vision. You know, myself and the academy director, who was amazing to work with, gave me a lot of ownership in terms from a leadership perspective. Never once in 7.5 years asked me about a result, not once.
Yeah,
it was a good job, as I probably would have lost my job after about 6 months, but did you know, he was just so supportive, you know, and win, lose or draw, we were very calm about what we were doing. And yeah, our vision was very clear in terms of the type of players we wanted to develop and the type of environment we wanted.
Yeah.
And it wasn't about winning or losing. That was just a byproduct. And our thought process was, and it's something that I got from yourselves, Pete, was the players need to experience it all. They need to experience winning well. They need and playing well. They need to experience winning well and not playing so well, and all the other outcomes. And as long as you're getting a blend of all of those, that's okay. Once you start to get, I heard recently about an academy manager who last year his under 18s and 21s were top of the league, and he called for a crisis meeting, and he called the coaches in and says, "We're not doing something right. We're top of both of these leagues." And it's that kind of thought process.
It's those different markers for success, I suppose, where if you're having to have those conversations with coaches, players and parents of, okay, yeah, from the outside, when we're going away and we're playing these big hitters and we're succeeding, but then actually we're putting them into a different environment and we're not succeeding as much, looking at what there is to learn rather than what is failing. It's actually, okay, this is just where we are, and there's room for growth here.
I think for me, Dan, because the FA have just conducted a huge research project about formats and also constraints that can be applied to the games. So one of the things they wanted to reduce was the number of headers, particularly for young players. And what they found out was that if you play a smaller format, you get the ball going out more. So if you insist on throw-ins as part of that smaller format, you're going to get a lot more headers because the ball is tend to be thrown in the air and someone puts their head on it. So the alternative to that was either a self-pass or a dribble in. But there was a little bit of resistance because people were saying, well, that doesn't look like the game of football. And I think what you've just described really eloquently is that the game should look differently for whatever returns you want from it. And if you're insisting on it's only a game that is meaningful and where learning is taking place, if it looks like this, I think we're missing loads of opportunities to develop our players.
And I agree. And I think as well, sending the message out to the parents that match days isn't this big thing. So I would often, even though I was taking the group, I would go out after the game had even started and I would watch sometimes half a game or the whole game way back from the pitch, just like under a tree, and just watch and let the players play. Because again, all the players that I speak to who are playing at a first team level, the majority of them will say that they can't either hear the manager. Sometimes they can't even hear their closest teammates.
Yeah.
It's so noisy in the stadium. So you're thinking you're actually, if you start with the end in mind is they've got to be independent on the pitch. And it's just us as youth coaches being able to let go of mistakes and expecting them. You know, I think sometimes our expectations are that they're not just mini adults, they're actually a better version of the adults. So, you know, by parents then seeing, gosh, he's over there, he's not on the side of the pitch and he's not screaming and shouting at the ref and whatever, I'm checking to see if the players, where they're at in terms of the philosophy, can they do it without being dependent on the coach?
Yeah.
And if they can, great. If they can't, then you learn about where they're at.
Yeah, brilliant. So if we move it on then, so you went from MK Dons, which with the best will in the world is one of the smaller academies, even though it's got a huge reputation for developing, you know, good players and players who can certainly get a profession and a livelihood from the game. Then tell us a little bit about Arsenal, because my impressions of Arsenal when I've been to Hale End is that, wow, this is, you know, it's a bit like paradise if you're a football coach or a football player. Tell us about your time at Arsenal.
I mean, Arsenal, again, the timing was very similar to going to the FA, actually, that it was under new leadership, under Per Mertesacker, and he had just put in place like a vision and a mission, etc. He had an idea around his version of the four-corner model, but that was it. It wasn't a living, breathing philosophy, if you like. So myself and the other phase leads were responsible with the head of coaching and the academy manager to bring that to life on and off the pitch. So that was a good experience in terms of sort of being able to take what I'd learned in my previous roles. You never pick up, or I certainly don't ever go into a new job and say, we did this at MK Dons or we did that at AFA. I always think, right, I'm at a different organisation with a different history and tradition. What's going to work here?
Yeah.
So from that point of view, it was quite a sort of strategic role, if you like, in terms of, like I said, bringing things to life and a lot of role modelling, really, because if the academy values are discipline, humility and respect, which is what they were, then first and foremost, that's got to be shown by the staff. And like you say, when you are in Disneyland type facilities, you've got to show a lot of humility and not forget where you've come from and actually try and put in place certain things which bring us all down to earth, not just players but staff as well, because you get so much.
Yeah.
You get too much, and some of that is out of your control. So what you then need to do is make sure that you put other things in place that you can control that allows you to live by your values.
What did you take to Arsenal then, and what did you try to develop in your work with the coaches, with the program that you would like to build there, and obviously be remembered for? What would be the main things that you would focus on?
I mean, I think similar sort of principles in terms of maximising your time with players. So when they'd arrive, and they'd sort of arrive at random times because of the North Circular. And initially there was a bit of a culture there that when players arrive early, they go up to the gym and they foam roll. And there is a time and a place for that. And certainly more important at certain ages than others. But the ages that I was working at, under 15s and 16s, we felt that it was too missed of an opportunity. So we had some really talented coaches there in terms of ball mastery. So we changed the culture of that to put your boots on, get outside. There's a coach there waiting for you. Arrival activities are in place. And what it did is it developed a culture of players wanting to get there, or the boys wanting to get there early, because they didn't want to miss out, because that was often the best part of the session. Then they'd have to come into me. But they would have like 30, 40 minutes with our skills coach, get lots of... And then what you then have to do is, and again, it's when I was at MK Dons, I didn't work with an MDT department because we didn't have the human resources like we did at the FA. So I guess what I learned at the FA was about collaboration and working with different departments. So it wasn't just a case of, oh, sports science, they're not going upstairs, they're going out there. They work together in terms of, on specific days, what are the skills that would fit on that day? And even like the reps and the fields, the pitch size. And then it just gave a bit of structure to that program. And it just made everybody feel part of that process, because otherwise you end up with some staff that are very happy and some staff that are very unhappy. And that's not what you want. You want it to be a joint thing and everyone to feel like they've got a voice. So I guess that was quite a big shift in terms of when the boys were in, the time on the pitch as well. You know, I'm a bit unsure about moving into like physical periodization models at too early an age.
Yeah.
Again, just based off my own research in terms of players from years gone by who would play 5, 6, 7 games a week, and then we're putting all these constraints on young players. And I know we can't get those days back, and it's not we wouldn't be able to research whether that was fit for purpose or not. And I'm sure for everyone that came through, some a lot still didn't. But when we used to play your South American teams, when we're at the FA, they would openly tell us, yeah, in the clubs here, they're playing Saturdays, they play Sundays, they play Wednesdays, they do this on Thursdays. And you're thinking, wow, you know, surely if you want to get good at something, you need to do it more, not less. It's like anything.
Yeah.
So our training sessions were generally 2 hours long and the players worked hard. But again, it was where the variety came in was smaller area days and larger area days and that kind of thing. So the periodization was more based off the returns we wanted technically, tactically, and the physical was just a byproduct of that.
Yeah.
The other thing as well is we were very objective with our coaching model. So the head of coaching at the time and some of the coach education provision we were given was very much on an objective football coaching model. So I think that was very beneficial to players and staff in that when you're talking to players, they're very clear on what you're saying. So for example, we wouldn't say, you showed a lot of desire today in the game, because we would find that to be very subjective. So we had a culture where it would be you made a lot of good forward runs, or you were tracking your runner, you tracked your runner really well today, or you counter pressed very well. So it's a football action rather than a subjective comment, if you like.
So I think
our football methodology was very clear and very well structured. And then I think just of course the playing style, etc., is that's sort of a non-negotiable from that side of it. The demands we put on the players within the playing style. But I think from a plan do review perspective, particularly a model that suits part-time coaches, because obviously in that context, it's not like you're at the FA where everyone's full-time and we can just sit in St. George's for 2 days and talk about the last camp.
Yeah.
Here you've got coaches who have got other jobs that come in, and now you've got to manage your expectations of them. So we work very closely with the analysis department to make sure we had a session library, so those coaches, when they came in, didn't feel under too much pressure. If they knew, for example, we were doing a passing exercise and we've told them beforehand, you can have 11 players. So they know they're going to do like a 4v4 plus 3, but then they come in and now they've got 9. They're not panicking or thinking, oh, I can't do a passing exercise now, I've only got 9.
Yeah.
Because we had a really well laid out session library. So they would then know, right, okay, I can do a 4v3 plus 2. And they could click and see the area size, the video animation. And it just allowed them to then come in, and we'd say to them, look, go and have some food, just decompress from your work day and the traffic that you've just been stuck in. Don't rush, and then come out when you're ready.
Yeah.
So I guess our plan do review had to be very adaptable to who our audience were and our team was.
Yeah. And that, Dan, is very similar to, you know, your arrival activity for the players. That's a time for them to settle, to them, you know, to get in the right headspace.
Yes.
It's really interesting that you're doing the same with your coaches. Mm. And then obviously when the two things come together, then hopefully that's where the magic happens. So
yeah.
And I think the importance of those arrival activities. We've visited on a number of occasions, haven't we, Lauren?
Yeah, and, it was in the episode that we did with Sally Needham, and it's funny, she used the phrase, a dysregulated adult can't help to regulate a dysregulated child. And so actually, if the coach, especially if they're working part-time, or if we kind of tune this down to grassroots, if they've just come, they've just had an argument with the partner, or they've just had a really bad day at work, they've just been, I don't know, someone's had road rage and it's really rubbed them up the wrong way. If they're then coming in and they've still got all of this energy, then they're not in a good position, or neither should they be probably in front of a group of kids or in the right frame of mind to pass on useful information. So it's just nice. And I think it's something that whether you are working with the big hitters or whether you are working with really limited resources, that just that knowledge is something that you can... and you should be acting on. It's one change that is in your control, and that actually, if that is, you know, what is happening in these big hitter clubs, and actually the more consistent everybody can be with that, then fingers crossed all of these kids and anyone participating in sports academy or not is going to have is going to have a much better experience of it. So
exactly. Yeah.
Hi coaches, just a quick break to remind you about our 10-week coaching plan that's available now. It's the perfect support for the start of the new season, helping you structure your sessions with expert guidance and keep your players developing whilst having fun. For more information and to start using the plan today, head to thesessioncollective.co.uk.
And it's a bit like, again, they're very similar principles to work anywhere you work in terms of, so take in terms of the values, say respect. So one way that I try to model respect is in my first month there, we played in a Premier League 6v6 tournament over in Birmingham. And I remember we won the first game, whatever. And we're going to play the second game. And one of the coaches said, are you going to keep the same team? And I said, no, I'm changing the whole team. Because we had two teams, if you like. One was on the bench and one played. They all got to play in the first game. But in terms of who was starting the second game, sorry, I should say. So I said, no, the ones who didn't start the first game will start the second game. And he was like, but we just won. And I said, yeah, but what's the point of those being here if they're not going to play? And actually, we won the tournament. But for me, what I tried to get across to the staff was, for me, the winning was that everyone won, because I kept a log of starts and coming on off the bench and minutes played, and it was nearly equal for all of them.
Wow.
Despite some are obviously better than others, at a club like that, the gap isn't so wide between the bottom and the top. And actually, one boy who, he won't mind me saying this, who was maybe deemed to have been, he's not going to play maybe as much as the others. He plays in Serie A now, and we're in regular contact. And you know, just for the coaches, he would have had a lot of people in his life who have influenced him, but they don't forget. You know, they've got long memories, and they'll remember who treated me fairly, who treated me well. It's like that thing of everyone wants to feel special. Everyone's got written on their head, make me feel special. And for me, that was early on. That was me sort of laying a marker quite early on that, yes, we want to win this tournament, but we're going to win it in the right way, on and off the pitch.
Yeah. What a great message for the whole game, really.
Yeah.
Particularly, and I don't want my comments to come across as a downer on the grassroots game, but I think that kind of approach is still possible at any level.
Yes.
And if you've got children who come every session, come every weekend and want to play, we are duty bound to give them the opportunity to play. And I think that's a great example at the level you're working at, Dan. I was going to mention earlier that we've drawn you up to the dark north, haven't we, with your next role, which is at Everton. I mean, obviously working at Arsenal and then coming to Merseyside, working with the... you know, the Evertonians. Any differences? Any similarities?
Yeah, it's not what people would expect in terms of, I think there might be a bit of a perception that up north it's the
cloth cap
more
and whippets.
Aggressive, and body, the style, whether it's the style or play or the way people are with each other. And it couldn't be further from the truth, actually. It maybe it was in a previous time, but I can only go off what I experience now. And a lot of similarities in terms of, and when I say similarities, I think you get positive and some not so positive wherever you go. And I try to remind people of that here, that if there's a bit of a challenge that the staff are facing, to remind them that, yeah, that was very similar when I worked at such and such place, and this is how we overcame it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I know that happens at such and such club as well. Or so, and it's just people getting a perspective, really, that no football club's perfect. Everyone's got their own challenges, and our role is to navigate through that as much as possible.
So your role at Everton, is that with the under-18s?
No. So basically I work with, I do have a little bit of involvement with the under-18s, but it's more so under-21s, loan players and some first team players, in terms of basically helping the boys to prepare for either going on loan, then supporting them when they're on loan. I mean, it's on paper, it's technically, tactically. But as we know, you do most of your work in the other two corners, you know, because, you know, particularly the lads, for example, who are on loan, one week they start a game and they win. The following week, they might be out of the team or out of the squad.
Yeah.
And then you're trying to sort of reassure them that, okay, that's part of the experience. And why do you think that's happened? Okay. There might not be any particular reason, but you've just got to control what you can control. Are you training well? Are you preparing well? Are you the first in? Are you the last out? Because I always say to them, look, wherever you go on loan, you've got to go there with elite Premier League behaviours, if that's where you want to end up. And I've supported the club in terms of putting in place individual development plans, process, which is being utilised throughout the club. And it's very similar to the concept that we followed at the FA with like VMOS and goal trees, in terms of, you know, having an aspirational vision and then your outcome, your season purpose, your and then what your strengths in the four corners, and then your learning objectives, and going through like the what, why, the how. And the who as well, what member of staff is going to support you with this.
Yeah.
But the most important part on all that for me really is, one, the top line of the player saying, I want to be this. Because then you can always go back to that when they start to become a little bit, you know, go off piste a little bit. You can bring them back and say, hang on a minute, you said you wanted to achieve this.
Yeah.
Those were your words, not mine. And then they say, okay, yeah. So it always gives you that platform.
Yeah.
And then the why, because we can talk a lot about what people want to improve at, and a lot of the times the how are we going to do that on a week-to-week basis. But when you then challenge them and say, why do you want to work on that? That's the bit for me where their brain can really process and buy into the plan.
Yeah.
So I think we've got a good process in place with the players, and a good culture in terms of, although I work with those boys who are sort of in and around first team environments, and like the ones who go with the first team, making sure that then they're getting additional work technically, their analysis, etc. And we've got a daily tracker of that. So we keep track of everything from a learning perspective. What it then does, it kind of creates this flock culture where the others see this and they start asking. And I never turn a player away, and I always protect time in my schedule for players. For me, they're the most important people. And if they want a one-to-one and it's going to last an hour, it's going to last an hour.
Yeah.
Because although I'm talking a lot on this, I try to follow like an 80-20 principle where they speak for 80% of the time. And I often show that to coaches on coach education events, where I'll show them video clips of a meeting with a player, and I'll show them one where we're looking at a clip, and I ask the player a question, and there's just silence for like 15, 20 seconds. So then I just ask another open question, and then he then starts to give me some answers. And I basically show them to him to say, how often would we just jump not in. Have that patience?
Yeah.
And I said, he's thinking. Give him time to think about what he's going to say, because it's like with the questions you're asking me now, I've got a notepad here and I'm having to write a couple of things down in terms of what you're asking me or what I'm going to say. And yet when we ask them a question, I feel like sometimes as coaches, we want them to answer us within 1 second and we want the meeting done in 1 minute.
Yeah.
When actually for me, if you really are in this learning space, give them as much time as they need.
Yeah. I think what you described, Dan, really clearly, I mean, my work and a lot of the stuff we're covering on these podcasts is about that magical place of development where you're very, very young, the world's in front of you, anything is possible. And what you've described is that in getting to the top, there are so many speed bumps, you know, hills to climb, cliffs to fall off and recover from again. And I think the support that we can wrap around players will help more and more try to achieve what they're actually going after. Because this is not easy. This is absolutely not easy. I think we look at the top players and we think, oh, they've got all this money, they've got all these cars. But I tell you what, their resilience, their ability to keep bouncing back from everything that is thrown at them and from every setback is incredible. And I think the development that we're talking about can actually help that. And then people like you, just at that real crucial point, you know, between first team and loans and being moved to another club, it's so crucial that we've got experts working at that level to get as many through as we can. So it's really fascinating to hear about.
Thank you. Yeah. And I think from my side, I think the fact that, one, I've had some experience in first team football, so I've got that empathy, one, for the coaches and managers in terms of how tough it is, but also I'm probably a bit more well-rounded now in terms of the players need to be able to do X, Y, and Z, as people often talk about doing the basics of the game as competing, winning your duels, winning second balls. And I'll say to them, yeah, that is a non-negotiable at any level, but it's certainly more so at the lower end. But also a basic of the game is your first touch and weight of pass.
Yeah.
You know, that's a basic of the game as well. And like with the additional technical work we give our players, they need it.
Yeah.
It's not something that you stop in the foundation phase. They need it sometimes more than any. And so that would be one thing. But also I think we often ask players to get out of their comfort zone. But I think, do we do that as coaches? So one of the reasons I wanted to come up here is I can help relate to, say, some of the boys that they recruit from down south.
Yeah.
We could say that they're having they might be having a bit of a slow start or a slow day. And I can say to the staff, look, it's not easy, you know, moving from down there to up here. We've got a different accent for a start. We're away from our families. The roads are different. The signs are different. And that's just for me as an adult.
Yeah.
So imagine what it's like for them at 16, 17, 18. So hopefully I've got a bit more perspective from that side of it. And the crucial role, I think, with the role, but maybe not just my role, but any role is adding value. So not stating just the obvious to players, but how do we add value to their game and add something that's missing and open their minds to something they hadn't thought of?
Yeah.
And for me, that's the critical bit. But then it's a process to get there.
Yeah.
And it's not going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I guess I try to be Mr. Positive and Mr. Perspective often here. Not to say others aren't like that, but I try to be consistent with that message, because they're going to be up and down. And I know so many players that I've worked with who, I'd say the best example, and someone who we lost recently from the MK Dons family, George Baldock, who for me is like the best example you could ever have in terms of getting to the Premier League. And very few would have expected it, including me. I remember him. I was at his minute silence a few weeks ago with previous players and staff. And the academy manager reminded me that when I went with the first team at MK Dons on their pre-season tour to Ireland, that I phoned him to say George was in tears on that trip and he was struggling. Could he have a word with him afterwards? Because academy manager had worked with him a lot more than me. And he just had that resilience about him. He had an older sibling who everybody talked about. He was always referred to as Sam's brother rather than George. That was a label he had. And he's still to this day the best trainer I've ever seen. And what he did was go from going online to Iceland, to Tamworth, to Northampton, and he ended up getting a promotion in every league, League Two, League One, Championship, played in the Premier League, not just once or twice, seasons, and playing it being an international. So I think the more we can hang on to examples like that to inspire us to say, none of us know where these boys are going to end up. I'd missed that crystal ball meeting. So it's about how do they get there and when.
Yeah.
Because there's boys here that I would be happy to say in a meeting, I think he'll play in the Premier League, but it might be in 5 years' time.
Yes.
And he might have to go on five loans.
Yeah.
And those loans are going to be up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want examples, I can give you 100 of people that have gone through that. So I don't know if we do enough work in coaching on journeys and speak to players. Find out from them what helped them, what didn't, what the struggles were.
Yeah.
Because like you say, sometimes people just see the end and they forget.
It's very easy to take your eye off the ball, isn't it? But I mean, that's a fascinating insight, Dan. So just to finish off, I mean, I'm at the end of my career. I'm just ready to sail off into the sunset and disappear at some point.
I'll join you.
No.
He's never here anymore, Dan. Yeah. He's never here. No, I've been orphaned, basically. He's off to Australia this weekend. Yeah, it's nonstop.
But you're very much still in the melting pot and, you know, and a really integral part of development in this country. How would you like to be remembered? What will people say about Dan Michici in the future?
I think I think when you've approached coaching like I have, you know, you'll have lots of differing views on your approach and your style, etc. And that's fine. I think I learned a long time ago, you'll never please everybody. So don't even bother trying. And I'm like that. When I regularly get asked to present at different things, I'm not in there thinking, right, I want all these people to think afterwards, he's incredible. But as long as they can take one thing away and I guess I've got to this point in my life now where I'm like, I just want them to think, oh, he's a good guy. You know, he's got humility. He doesn't think like he knows it all. And with the players, you know, for them to remember is somebody who tried to help them.
Yeah.
And was approachable and gave them my time, because I think that's our biggest commodity. And I think sometimes in the football industry, the day just leaves you by. Like, they come in, their day is all structured, and before you know it, they're gone.
Yeah.
And I'm always conscious of, have I had interactions with them all this week? What have those interactions entailed? First of all, from a human perspective, and then from a coaching perspective. And I'm always keeping my eye on things like that in terms of training finishes. If I see one or two wandering up the other end of the pitch and I say to them, where are you off to? And they'll say, I want to do extras on whatever. I'll go with them. And if I'm going to be out there for another half an hour, 45 minutes, so be it.
Yeah.
And I'll go with them and I'll put something in place that I try and make it fun, it's engaging, it's competitive. Like I say, you just hope that over the years that that's how they remember you, that, you know, you were a good human being and you try to help them.
Yeah, well, and I think things that really strike me from all of your journey, Dan, in all of the places that you've worked, that you're always incredibly consistent with the message that you want to put out there, but incredibly compassionate. And I think those two things, I feel like you always talk about the players, whatever level, international or not, as am I actually connecting with them as a person enough? And that whether that is kids, whether that is adults, that's really at the root of everything, I think, and really, really fruitful relationships, and the outcomes of these relationships and the practice will be more beneficial if we're actually just being open with each other and just talking to each other. And I think that's clear from the two chats that we've had, that's the legacy that you have created and will continue to create. So I think that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, I'd got a tear welling up then when you were talking about you just wanted to be a nice guy. And you know that thing about time, about they come in and then before you know it they're leaving. My 35-year journey now feels exactly like that. That it's started and it's just gone in a heartbeat. So I think the differences and the time that you can spend with individuals and help them understand that you are there for them is absolute gold dust. And it's worth, you know, anything else. For you to approach it like that, I think it's quite unique. Well, it's not unique, but I think it does single you out as someone quite special. So, Dan, it's been brilliant having you on.
Thanks.
And
thanks
so many
me.
Golden nuggets. You know, the Machichi files, I think there could be other...
There'll be another one,
could
I'm
be
sure.
Other chapters in the Machichi files.
No problem.
Thanks.
Anything for you both.
Thanks so much, Dan. It's been great to talk
great
to you again.
Yeah.
Thanks, you for
Dan.
All your support, Dan. Take Have care. A lovely rest of your day.
And you. Take care. See you later.